Support comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting the film series Testigo Witness, Goya in the Movies. Held on select Fridays in May, each film touches upon artist Francisco de Goya's visions of the world, kicking off with Pan's Labyrinth by Guillermo del Toro on May 10th at NortonSimon.org.
You have the chance to win a spring super sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. I hope you had a wonderful weekend. Beautiful weather for most of it. So glad to have you with us to start the week together. We have much news to talk about, including next hour, a three-year initiative that's a collaboration of the Getty and the City of Los Angeles to identify many more places of African-American history and culture within Los Angeles. I've got a bunch of places that I want to put out there for nomination. I want to hear from you, the places that you think are most important to recognize as African-American historical or cultural sites or movements that could also be included, because perhaps it wouldn't have to actually be a physical location. That's coming up next hour right here on Air Talk. But right now, as we so often do, we take a look at the very latest on COVID-19 and a very big week with vaccination eligibility already scheduled to increase. At the same time, our supply of vaccine is going down. With us to talk about this is Dr. Dean Blumberg, professor of medicine and chief of pediatric infectious diseases at UC Davis Children's Hospital. Dr. Blumberg, welcome back. Hope you had a great weekend.
Thanks, I did. How about you, Larry?
Good. It was very, very nice. A lot of work around the house and a couple long walks. Very nice. Let's start right off with what's happening this week. For those health departments that have not already expanded the eligibility for vaccination to 16 years of age and up, others will be following by Thursday of this week when the state eligibility expands to 16 and up. But we also, because of a lack of deliveries of Johnson & Johnson vaccine, are going to see an overall drop in supply. So what's going to come from this?
Yeah, so it's been interesting because initially, of course, with vaccine shortages and very limited supply, the priority scheme, you know, tended to be pretty complicated and a bit painful. And it's nice that now that we do have expanded vaccine availability, that it's a much simplified scheme. People can go and get their vaccine based on age alone. That makes it so much simpler for everybody involved, for the general public, for those administering vaccine, and et cetera. And it's just too bad that we had a little bit of a glitch with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine with the manufacturing, and that's going to impact their vaccine availability in the short term. But hopefully they'll quickly recover.
Yeah. And at this point, do we have any sense how long it's going to take for everybody 16 and up who wants to get vaccinated to actually get an appointment?
Yeah, I don't know that. I don't know how long it's going to take for that. But what we have seen is that most, the states request the vaccine. We've seen some states now in the country that haven't requested vaccine even when it's been available. So we do feel that the shortage of vaccine is easing up. And I know at UC Davis Medical Center, we've been vaccinating, basically using up all vaccine, as soon as it's available. So I'm hoping that with the easing of the shortages, that we will have more availability and everybody can just get their vaccine with an appointment, and pretty soon, hopefully not even need an appointment, just walk in. I'd like to see that available. That would make things even simpler.
Well, and as we've been saying all along, it appears we may be just a few weeks away from being awash in vaccine and everybody who'd been clamoring to get one getting vaccinated. So, this could all end up with people fully vaccinated in pretty short order here.
Right. So right now we've had about 20% of people in California are fully vaccinated. And, you know, that, I'm impressed with that number because 20% is a substantial amount. It's not high enough to get the herd immunity that we need to really limit transmission. For that, we need somewhere between probably 70 to 80% or so. But it's still a very, very good start.
Well, one of the things I keep hearing from people who, you know, I think their responses are very, you know, finely tuned because of what we've all been going through this past year. But there's a lot of fear about variants and will they be able to elude the coverage of the vaccines? But again, you know, looking at the efficacy of the mRNA vaccines, what we've seen so far, even with these variants becoming deeply entrenched in different locations, I mean, it seems to me that the vaccines are doing quite well.
Yeah, so the current vaccines that we have, which were based on the previous circulating strains, appear to be pretty much just as effective, maybe slightly less effective against the UK variant, but pretty much effective against that variant. And that's the predominant strain that's circulating in the US right now. Now, there is concern about some of the other variants, the Brazilian and South African variants. They appear to be more resistant to vaccine-induced immunity, and we still don't have good numbers to state precisely, you know, how much less effective the vaccines may be against those variants. But the more people we get vaccinated, the less circulation there is, the less replication of the virus, then there's less opportunity to spread these variants and even develop newer variants.
So what about the original Wuhan strain of the virus? Can it just not outcompete these other newer strains? Is that why, for example, here in California, we're seeing the UK variant and our own two California variants seemingly pushing out the one from Wuhan?
So what happens is as the virus replicates, it makes mistakes, and so it does get mutants, variants all the time. And some of those variants are less fit, meaning maybe they don't bind quite as tightly to our cellular receptors, the ACE2 receptors that we have. And then those variants don't really circulate much. But if they bind tighter, if there's some advantage to the new variants, then they'll be the predominant strain in circulation, and the other variants will gradually fade into the background. So that's what we generally see. It's survival of the fittest, and the most efficiently transmitted variants are going to become the more predominant strains.
And the thing to remember, of course, as we've talked about before, is that the virus is constantly creating these different variations, and most of them don't go anywhere because they can't compete.
Right, exactly. So some of them can't compete, and when they can't compete, they just die away. They don't replicate efficiently, and then we just don't see them very, very much.
All right. You have questions for our guest, Dr. Blumberg. We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. I know you say that the 20% national vaccination is not herd immunity. But looking at what we're seeing here in California, I wonder if you couple the vaccination rate with the number of people that were exposed to COVID-19, especially during the big surge that we had a couple of months ago, if in combination what we're seeing is some significant herd immunity here.
Yeah, so those who've been previously infected, the estimates are that there's about 20 to 30% of the population that's been previously infected. So if they're immune, if they have long-lasting immunity, plus the 20% that have been vaccinated, you know, that gets us up to 40 to 50%. So we're getting there. So that's great. But what we'd like to see, especially with the UK variant, which is 50% more transmissible, is we'll probably need about 70 to 80% of the population vaccinated to achieve that herd immunity, in addition to those who've been previously infected, because that is a much more transmissible strain.
Dr. Dean Blumberg, UC Davis Children's Hospital, where he's chief of pediatric infectious diseases and professor of medicine at UC Davis Medical, joining us. We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. John asks on the AirTalk page, if someone has a needle phobia Is it okay to use an over-the-counter topical numbing cream like lidocaine prior to the shot, or would that have any sort of negative effect on the shot itself, on the benefit from the vaccine?
No, that would be fine. And there's other things. There's some people may have heard of the cream called Emla. You have to apply that about 20 to 30 minutes before. And even ice. If you just ice up, your shoulder, your deltoid, you ice that up ahead of time. That'll numb the pain also. So there are several things you can do. The other thing you can do is you can seek out, once it's available, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, because that's just one dose. And so then you won't have to go through it twice.
One of the last of the school districts to go back to some in-person teaching is LA Unified. They'll do that tomorrow at their campuses. If you're an LA Unified parent and you have any questions for our guest, who is a pediatric expert, we're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Anthony writes on the AirTalk Facebook page, I'm wondering if not getting good sleep a few nights before the vaccination has a negative effect on the effectiveness of the vaccine. I heard something about it, he says, but wondering if that's unreliable.
Yeah, sleep is important in terms of maintaining immunity. So it's possible that people who aren't sleeping well, who have sleep deprivation, can have weakened immune responses. And so that theoretically could be a consideration. However, I'm confident that the vaccine formulations will vastly overcome any kind of minor decrease in immunity that would result from sleep deprivation. The vaccines are designed with a cushion in terms of inducing immunity to overcome problems like that.
And remember, they were used on a large group of people, presumably some of whom had a sleep interruption or lack of sleep and were included in the overall, strong results in the showing as well. This comes from Wendy, who says, my close relative was stuck in China for the past year, just returned to L.A. after getting fully vaccinated in China. With the news about the Chinese vaccine's effectiveness being lower, I wonder if my close relative should now get a vaccine here in the U.S. as well. He's 75 years old, has some risk factors for severe COVID. Wants to know if there are risk factors about mixing COVID vaccine. He got the second dose of the Chinese vaccine, or one of the Chinese vaccines, because I think they have multiples, about 3 weeks ago.
There's just very little actual data to base recommendations off in this circumstance, because the vaccines have not been studied well in terms of mixing and matching. So we really don't know. But I will say this, that the CDC is very clear in terms of the opening up, in terms of fully vaccinated adults getting together without masking. They say that really counts for those who've been vaccinated with vaccines approved for use in the U.S., and that applies to quarantine related to international travel also. So the Chinese vaccine, of course, is not approved for use in the U.S., and so there is some doubt about the protection that's afforded with that. So if you are in a high-risk group, such as being older than 65, such as this person who's 75, I'd recommend talking with your physician about that and making a decision based on an individual basis. But there's going to be very little guidance from organizations like the CDC on that.
All right, 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Sarah writes on the page, the day after I received my vaccine, my menstrual period arrived 2 weeks early. I've heard the vaccine has that effect on some women. You have any details on that, doctor?
I don't have that much information on that. The vaccine itself can act as a stress on the immune system because it revs up the immune system. And so we have seen other things happen after vaccination that have been disturbances in normal biological function. So, but I haven't seen a lot of data on that.
866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Renee of Pasadena writes, says, my uncle sent me a video yesterday of a pathologist in Idaho speaking to the state legislature. I went through all of what this doctor said. To make a long story short, the video is blowing up on the internet. and people are following, and I'm paraphrasing what Renee writes, following what the doctor says, that there is no more COVID-19 in Idaho, wearing masks is stupid and unnecessary, and that rather than vaccines, take vitamin D and ivermectin. So she's wondering about, you know, where you've got examples like this of physicians and others who have become darlings of social media, who, you know, take a counter approach to the you know, general positions of public health officials.
Yeah, I saw that video too. You know, some of these people are more articulate than others. You know, the ones that come off mix some science with some of the fraud that they're perpetuating. And so the more science that they include, the more that it looks a little bit real. So there's about 10% of what this person says that's true. But it's really foolish. I mean, to say that masks don't work goes against all the evidence that we have about masks working. We've got definitive scientific studies on that. And to bring in something like vitamin D might sound good. We know vitamin D is important with immunity, and we know that in populations that are vitamin D deficient, that infections may be more severe. So there's a kernel of truth to that, but not everybody is vitamin D deficient. So giving extra vitamin D to somebody who's not deficient was going to result in zero benefit at all. Idaho has several counties that are hotspots for transmission right now. So it's just not true.
All right. We're talking with Dr. Dean Blumberg, UC Davis. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Just before we break, I just want to mention that Minnesota, the police chief in Minnesota, in Brooklyn Center, says that the officer who fired a single shot that killed a black man, that's in a stop that occurred over the weekend, that the officer meant to discharge a taser instead of his firearm. That comes from the chief of police in Brooklyn Center, Minnesota. Over the weekend, there were protests and disturbances with the people upset about this incident, the shooting of an African American in this suburb of Minneapolis. He was fatally shot, was the man, after a traffic stop. But again, the police chief, Tim Gannon, says this was an accidental discharge. We'll give you updates throughout the course of the day. We'll continue our conversation with Dr. Blumberg in just 1 minute on Air Talk. It's coming soon this Sunday. It's the 19th Annual Film Week Academy Awards Preview. I would have never guessed when I started this nearly two decades ago, we'd have it every year since. Typically, of course, at the beautiful historic Theater at Ace Hotel in downtown Los Angeles, which was the flagship of the United Artists chain of theaters. They had a remarkable opening night in 1927, but we're not going to be going back there because of the pandemic, of course. So for the first time in these many years, it'll be a virtual event, but we'll be coming your way live, not recorded. It's live this Sunday, 1 o'clock in the afternoon. 10 Film Week critics will be joining me from throughout Southern California. They'll be at home. I'll be coming your way from my studio here at KPECC, Studio A. So we'll do the program with the critics on the major Oscar categories, and we'll be able to take some questions from our audience as well. It'll likely be the biggest crowd we've ever had, but you'll be in your home to be able to take part in it. You can get your tickets by visiting kpecc.org/in-person. That's kpecc.org/in-person, our 19th Annual Film Week Academy Awards Preview. And it's been quite a year for movies, even though we haven't been able to go to movie theaters. Some extraordinary films, wonderful work that we're going to be able to talk about coming up this Sunday at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. Dr. Blumberg, I don't know if you're a film buff or not, but it's been quite a year for great movies.
Yeah, it has. My wife and I were just talking this weekend about going to see a movie in person, and it's just so odd to even talk about that and imagine that. And we were looking at some of the local movie theaters, which ones were open and what that experience would be like.
Yeah, it's going to be strange to sit there with a mask for 2 hours or whatever, watching the movie. But it'll be nice, even with the reduced capacity, I think, to have that communal experience. I'm looking forward to going back at some point.
Right? I mean, that's a difference.
Yeah, no question. All right, we continue with your questions for Dr. Dean Blumberg, UC Davis Children's Hospital, 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722. Kay in Glendale wonders what the most effective COVID-19 test is currently.
You know, the PCR assays, the nasal swabs that are the PCR assays, are all highly effective. They're somewhere between 97 to 99% sensitive. So those are the best tests. The antigen tests, like the Abbott test, those are about 80% sensitive. So any of the PCR assays, I don't have any preference for one over the other. All of them are really excellent.
Okay. And are those the ones that require that the swab go up deep into the nasal passage? Do all of them rely on that?
Yeah, those are the best swabs. The ones that go the deepest into the nasal passage, which is very uncomfortable, those are the ones that are the most accurate. Those are more accurate and more sensitive than doing the anterior nasal swab, the short swab, or the saliva tests. And some of those tests are the ones that are done in the laboratory themselves, but some of them are point-of-care tests, so they've developed them that they're 15-minute turnaround tests. So those are ones that you might see in clinics or emergency rooms.
866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Tammy in Pasadena asking some interpersonal advice. You have any recommendations for how to deal with being around other people who are not wearing masks?
Oh, that is so difficult. And, you know, I really don't know what to do. I mean, I'm not about to shame somebody and tell them to put on a mask. What I do is, if I am in public and it's somebody I don't know, is I just avoid them. So I just go around them. You know, I was at the farmer's market the other day, and one of the vendors was not wearing a mask. And I was it's a vendor that I usually buy from. And I just decided I wasn't going to buy from them that week because they weren't wearing a mask. And I didn't ask them. I'm not sure why they weren't wearing a mask. If it's someone you know, you can always say, you know, I'm not comfortable with not masking, could you please wear a mask? And right now we're in a kind of a transitional time because some people are vaccinated and other people aren't. So when you're with other adults who may be vaccinated or partially vaccinated, the default is to wear a mask and then say, well, what are you comfortable with?
866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Yeah, I've just found avoidance. Also with people who don't cover their nose, it's an ongoing problem with people with the mask riding down under their nostrils. 866-893-KPECC. Adam in Alhambra says, I have a 9-year-old son. My wife and I are both fully vaccinated. School's preparing to go back into session. I don't have a lot of fear, but I'm wondering what we should be watching out for and how do we protect him and his classmates and teachers?
Yeah, so the most important thing is the social distancing and the masking. So hopefully the school has a routine masking policy. What we found is that schools are very safe places when they do have appropriate policies in place. There's been studies that have shown that 3 feet of distancing is adequate in schools compared to the 6 feet that we normally talk about. And the reason that they do 3 feet is because the schools can't accommodate. Many schools can't physically accommodate the students if you did have that 6-foot requirement. But there's been excellent studies that have shown that the 3 feet distance in schools have adequately controlled transmission. And then it's also important to make sure that there's adequate testing and contact tracing. So if there are any cases, that then spread can be limited. But I think schools are great places. They're safe places for the children to be. There's very, very little child-to-child or child-to-staff transmission. And when the parent's vaccinated, then that is another guard against having transmission within the family.
Dr. Dean Blumberg, UC Davis Children's Hospital, with us, 866-893-KPECC. I don't know what you've seen with your patients, but we've been hearing that kids are surprisingly good at keeping their masks on, which I'm very surprised to hear that, at least. But what have you heard anecdotally, Dr. Blumberg?
Yeah, kids are very resilient. You know, if we have expectations and we're consistent with our expectations of them, then they will wear masks. It's the same thing with like bike helmets, where they might not want to wear them when they're cycling. But if parents are very consistent about that expectation, they will wear them all the time. And in fact, some of my colleagues who see kids routinely, what they comment on is that the kids in their practices are better at wearing masks appropriately than the parents. And they often mention that the parents have the mask below the nose and all. I think a lot of that is also some of our role models have been wearing them wrong. So if you watch any sports, boy, a lot of the coaches and players, if when they're on the bench, you know, on the sidelines, they're wearing the masks wrong, and they're constantly pulling their masks off to argue with the referees or umpires or whatever, and you know, that's a bad message to send.
Yeah, it's funny. It's ironic. They're pulling the mask down at the time when they're projecting the most out of their mouth. Joaquin in the Burbs writes on the page, if 3 feet works for kids, why doesn't it work for adults, adequate space or not?
Well, it does work. It doesn't work as well as 6 feet. So what the studies have shown is that there's about 90% decrease in transmission without mask wearing with a 3 foot distance. And if you go to 6 feet, then there's 95% decrease in transmission. And if you go to 12 feet, it's even more. So, you know, what are you going to decide on? So in the U.S., the CDC has decided that 6 feet is feasible for most situations. They've decreased that to 3 feet for children in school with the expectation that, quote, children are wearing masks. But the WHO and other countries take different tacks. So in Europe, many of the countries use 1.5 meters. So about 4.5 feet is what their standard is. So it is relatively arbitrary, but there is some science behind it.
Lisa in Ontario says she's been told she can't get her scheduled mammogram until about a month after a COVID vaccine. What would the reason for that be?
Gee, I don't know why, because I know that most of the hospital systems that I've been working with have not delayed preventative care, even for unvaccinated patients. We want people to come in for their preventative care, and the healthcare workers are presumably vaccinated and wearing masks, and then we ask the patients to wear masks, and we've seen very little, if any, transmission in those situations when the appropriate precautions have been in place. So that wouldn't be the recommendation of the healthcare systems that I'm familiar with.
Anival writes on the page, I got my J&J vaccine this past Thursday. I received pretty significant side effects that calmed down for the most part by Saturday night. However, everything still feels warmer than the outside temperature, and I get waves of hot flashes. Is this normal after a few days?
Yeah, I haven't heard that as a common side effect following immunization, but many people may have different alterations in their usual biologic processes following immunization, and especially if you've had a significant reaction such as a very sore arm or a fever or something like that. So I would hope that would get better over the next few days.
China Hand writes on the AirTalk page, Dr. Blumberg, ! Excited to talk with you. If a nursing mom is vaccinated, can she give immunity to her baby? Could she expel milk and give it to her toddler so he gets some immunity?
Well, we do think that there is some immunity passed on from vaccinated mothers through breastfeeding. So the vaccinated mothers will develop antibodies, and some of those antibodies will be the secretory IgA antibodies that are in breast milk. And so we know that breast milk has several advantages in terms of immunity and protecting children from infection. So this might help prevent infection. I don't know how much antibody is in breast milk. I don't know, there's no studies that I'm aware of that have a level of antibody that shows that it's protective. So I'm not sure how much protection there is, but it certainly can't hurt, and it might help. And I wouldn't know the dose in terms of breast milk for the toddler, I just don't know what the dose would be. So I'm not sure if that would protect and how much protection you'd accrue from that.
We have what's been one of the most frequently asked questions, but I'm wondering if we have a bit more information for an answer. Erin in Venice asks, for those that are pregnant, what trimester should the vaccine be given in if there is a choice? And is one of the vaccines better for someone pregnant than another?
You know, I do not recommend trying to time it to a trimester in general. We know that pregnant women are at higher risk for severe COVID. They're at higher risk for hospital admission and intensive care unit admission compared to women of the same age who aren't pregnant. So it's dangerous to get COVID during pregnancy, and it may induce preterm delivery also. So although there's little data in pregnant women, the CDC is collecting data. As of the last date that I've seen, the CDC does have information on during pregnancy of over 75,000 women who've been vaccinated and detailed information on more than 4,000 women who've been vaccinated in pregnancy. I'm not aware of any adverse outcomes with birth, with fetal outcomes. So I've been recommending vaccination during pregnancy, no matter what the trimester. Although, because people are nervous about it, I fully understand people might want to try to time that. And so some people have been waiting till the third trimester to vaccinate. And I don't have any preference for any of the vaccines. I don't see any theoretical reason for any of the vaccines to worry about them crossing the placenta and causing issues with the fetus or some of them having more adverse reactions than others.
I wonder, though, if with there being so much less COVID-19 out in the world, much less virus that's out there, does that change the recommendation? Because as you said, we know that for pregnant women, it can be a rougher go if she gets COVID-19 and have that effect on the fetus. But if the risks are significantly lower just because there isn't so much SARS-CoV-2 that's out in the world, does that maybe change the calculus of the decision?
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. So this is something that pregnant women should talk about with their physicians, and that's very important to take into account, is the risk of transmission within the community and the risk to themselves in terms of their exposures from their activities and what they do to protect themselves. So you can imagine somebody who doesn't go out much, who always masks, who always social distances, who lives in a community with very little transmission. Of course, there's be less benefit from being vaccinated in that situation, and then you might want to delay. And you can imagine the opposite, where there's more infections that are occurring. For example, in the state of Michigan right now, there's a lot of infection that's occurring, a lot of transmission, and somebody who's more out and about because of their job or their caretaking responsibilities, that person's going to be at increased risk, and that person may have more of a reason to be vaccinated.
Jesus writes on the Air Talk Facebook page, my parents both received Moderna shots by early March and are planning to visit family in Mexico in late April. They're both in their 70s and would be considered vulnerable. What advice would you give to those traveling into countries who may be behind in their vaccine distribution to help safeguard the travelers against variants that could get past their vaccine immune defenses?
Yeah, so there is more transmission in Mexico right now than there is in the U.S., and there has been less vaccination in Mexico also compared to the U.S. So that is certainly a concern. The issue with travel is that if you are traveling, you're going to have increased risk of exposure just due to travel, whether you're in a bus or on a train or in an airplane. You're going to be exposed to more people. Not all of them are going to be masking, and it may not be feasible to social distance all the time. And then if you're going to an area of higher risk, of course, there is an increased risk of transmission there also. So I would recommend people check out the CDC webpage on international travel. If you're fully vaccinated, they do say that you can travel, but they still do recommend masking. If you're not fully, for those who are not fully vaccinated, you know, they do have some recommendations for quarantine upon returning. And then it's very important to also check out the testing requirements, because different countries have different requirements for tests before you go there. And then upon return to the U.S., for the U.S., for air travel, there is required testing before getting on the plane, and the airlines are checking that.
All right. Dr. Blumberg, it's always a pleasure. We so appreciate the generosity of time and just the straightforwardness, clarity of your answers to all this wide range of questions that come at you. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you, Larry, and thanks for all the great listener questions this morning.
We have wonderful listeners and so glad that they're game every day to ask terrific questions of our experts. Dr. Dean Blumberg is the Chief of Pediatric Infectious Diseases at UC Davis Children's Hospital and Professor of Medicine as well at the UC Davis Medical School. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Coming up, the fate of a huge planned residential development in the Tejon Pass in far north Los Angeles County. The community would be called Centennial, but it suffered a big setback in court last week. We'll review it in 90 seconds.
The LAS Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAS.com/sweeps.